They can jump to light speed or something.
Yeah.
Welcome, everyone. Today is April 25th, 2017, and this is the Committee on Housing and Human Services, or Human Services and Housing. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 244. Would you like me to open up all the bills at once?
No, because they'll get confusing.
Okay. Welcome, Senator Gelser.
I just got a text from you. I assume you sent that a while ago. It's too late. All right, so which one are we on?
244.
Is she on the time limit, Madam Chair?
No, she's got 2 hours.
Uh-oh.
She's got 2 hours.
Don't do that.
She can use it.
Here, let me get comfortable. good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Albany and Corvallis and the chair of the Human Services Committee on the other side, and it's crossover day. You have many of our bills that we passed, most of them that don't cost money. The rest of them were down in Ways and Means. So Senate Bill 244 is a kind of a technical cleanup bill. What happens when the department receives information about abuse, but also about a license violation, which is, or a violation of a care standard, which is very different than abuse. It could be mold that is growing or lack of towels or hygiene supplies. The department is to notify certain individuals that that happens. For instance, if there is no toothpaste for the kid, you want to notify the director of that facility, because who can go get toothpaste? The director. You want to let them know right away. Unfortunately, the language about the notifications was written in the 1970s, and when we updated it with 1515 and people went back and reinterpreted it, it was very, very broad. So we are notifying more people than need to be notified, which creates a lot of work for the department and a lot of anxiety for the providers. So this narrows and limits the number of notifications that take place. And as I was explaining to you on the phone this morning, the definition of a governmental agency is because in the interpretation of the interpretation of the legislation and the way that it was written caused some people to believe that every time there was an allegation of an issue, you had to notify anybody that had any sort of a contract. And a governmental agency could be if somebody from Idaho was in a facility in Oregon, did we have to notify them? There was a debate about our CCOs, governmental entities, but we wanted to notify the Oregon Youth Authority because they do have kids. So this language of the governmental agency allows us to get to the Oregon Youth Department, Youth Authority, and the juvenile departments that are in the county, but not be crossing state lines and contacting CCOs, and it gets us to where people felt like we needed to be.
Okay. The only other person signed up is Cynthia. Would you like to come up and say anything about this? And then we can open up for questions, and then maybe Sarah, you can just stay there, and we'll just
keep going. Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the legislative coordinator for child welfare for Department of Human Services. And I don't really have much to add. We requested this change because we heard from child caring agencies that it was very uncomfortable to have us notify everyone in the world, and it was also a workload issue. So we feel like this language narrows it sufficiently.
Okay. All right. Then any other questions from the panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Janet, did you want to testify as well? Okay, great.
Good morning.
Janet Ahrens, Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. I appreciate Cynthia's comment. It is true that the reduction of notification to people who are outside of the state and not connected to the kids or have ancillary or distant relationships with providers is helpful. We are concerned about the enlarging list, however. Even though it narrows in one area, it still enlarges the list in some other areas. So that creates continuing concerns for us.
where it says governmental agency means executive, legislative, or judicial agency, department, board, commission, authority, institution, or instrumentality of the state, of a county, municipality, or other political subdivision. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Do you have any specific recommendations on how that should be narrowed?
Well, that's a new element added into existing legislation, so the simplest thing to do would be to
take out that bold part.
Right, to go back to the original language.
Okay. So, Senator Gelser, any?
I mean, going back to the original language would actually expand who you're notifying, because the definition of the governmental entity restricts it to Oregon counties and Oregon governmental entities, and it takes out all of the other states. So the number of entities that are contacted is less in 244. There's nothing new that is added. It's all an elimination and a reduction.
So it definitely restricts it to Oregon, because it says of the
yes.
state. And
which
is your
which
concern that it's institutions?
We're happy about.
So you're happy about the in-state, but you feel that it might broaden it, the number of organizations in the state that have to be notified?
Well, it broadens the number of entities that don't appear to be able to have any impact on child safety under a particular alleged or may have or suspected incident. So these are not substantiated that are going out to all of the entities, although we do support notification on substantiated.
Right.
So we're trying to figure out what it is that they would do mm-hmm. with the notification.
So can you give me an example of who this would include in this bill that wasn't included before, that's now included, that doesn't need to be?
Well, I'm not. Again,
yeah.
We're not clear
okay.
on what it is that those entities are to do with a notice of an alleged abuse or neglect or licensing violation.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, the organizations that are there, in order to have the contact, it's a governmental entity that has a contract with the organization to provide care to the child. So what you are looking at is an organization that personally has some responsibility for the child. And that's why both the juvenile departments and the youth authority really worked with us on that language around the governmental entity, because they have a responsibility for the children that are in their care. So the idea of that notification going to say, hey, you have a contract for Billy. Billy is in this facility, and Billy may have a history of eating glass, and there are persistently unfixed windows that are broken. The juvenile department or the youth authority that is responsible for that child is going to be able to better understand how that specific licensing violation, which again is not an abuse, may impact the specific safety of that child. So the idea around all of this, and most of this is existing law from the 1970s, is that mm-hmm. the entity that is responsible for the child needs to understand the conditions that are in place, because for any individual child, what might be unsafe for Chair Kenny Guyer mm-hmm. might be very safe for me, mm-hmm. but unless you're at that individual organization that's responsible for that person, you are not going to know. So that is what the intent of that is. This also really narrows in terms of when there is the allegation that there is a problem, one of these licensing violations. It significantly narrows the number of notifications that are happening, that more people are notified after the allegation is substantiated. Mm-hmm. But in that first piece, you're wanting to make sure that the organization knows, that those that are responsible for the physical care of mm-hmm. the child knows there is an allegation that there isn't food, for mm-hmm. instance. But this bifurcates that and limits both who is notified from the original list when there's an allegation and across the board entities that don't. An insurance company in Idaho really has no idea whether that broken glass impacts the individual, but an organization that is providing case management services for that individual or counseling for that individual would know that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I agree that there are entities who have a need to know. And in Representative Olson's bill 2903, we included the addition of juvenile court directors, which weren't previously in there, or juvenile departments, and the Oregon Youth Authority, because those are pretty common sense additions.
Mm-hmm.
The entities of commissions or boards or other kinds of appointments and getting broader in government, I'm still really struggling to see how that notification of a may have or an alleged could create some greater safety for a child or an environment. To substantiate it again, just want to confirm that we are we think that that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Madam Chair, may I? Okay, so Senator Gelser and Janet, both of you, I get where you're wanting to go with this. I mean, I remember having a conference call on this a few months back and everything in the development of this. I suspect then that you've stumbled on two incidents that caused you to get to this level. And then I'm just kind of, Janet, I guess the question to you then would be, are you aware of incidents that have occurred that actually this would be a benefit and, you know, the accountability measure of it?
Mr. Chair, I drafted this bill at the request of the agency and providers. And to be very clear, I'm very happy if this bill doesn't go forward at all.
I think that this bill does a lot to narrow, and I think that there's really good reception of the bill. And if there's any particular tweaking that needs to happen to make sure that while we narrow it in one way, we're not expanding in another way, I'd be interested in hearing if there's something specific that would make sure that we didn't inadvertently broaden in a way that the bill is aiming to reduce the workload. So if there's a specific way and some specific language, if it says any of these entities can be contacted if they have some direct contact with a child or some, I don't know what the language is, but if there's some way that gets, if there's an example of how this broadens it in a way that's going to increase workload, specific. I think that would help me if I understood a specific situation that this bill would now allow to happen that didn't in the past, and if we can, tweak the language to make sure that didn't happen. I don't know that we need to do that right here, but I think it deserves, another conversation to see.
And Madam Chair, if I may, the definition of governmental entity is up higher in the bill.
Yep.
The language that talks about the notification is the department shall immediately notify any governmental agency that has a contract with the child caring agency. So you are talking about a very direct with the child caring agency to provide care or services to a child. So it's very direct. It's only an entity that directly has a contract with that particular child caring agency for a child. So it's not any board or commission out there. The reason that we got to the boards and the commissions and that language that's there is that the youth authority was easier to get at because that is, an executive entity. The juvenile departments, depending on how a county is structured, you could have that as a more independent entity. It could be reporting to the Board of Commissioners. So that language had to be broader. We spent a lot of time with both the Department of Justice and Legislative Council trying to figure out how to get that right. And the juvenile departments, the county juvenile departments, were very concerned about making sure that they were not excluded. And that actually is the amendment that we added to the bill. From that's why it's a 244A was to fix that language in order to make sure that we were picking up the juvenile departments who were concerned that the streamlining removed them. Mm-hmm. But I would point out that the Department of Justice and Legislative Council having this question of does this add anybody or does it narrow have all said this narrows and gets to the intended purpose.
Okay. Good. Any other questions on 244?
Ron, did you say? I did actually. Yeah. I think Senator Gelser answered it because I'm looking at page 3, lines 39 and 40, that talk about the alleged deficiencies or violations to the government agency and the governing board responsible for the oversight of the agency. Is that accurate? And then it just limits in the definition of what a governmental agency is as the potential for who could be notified. And I guess my question is to clarify, this is not a must notify all governmental agencies that could possibly in any way have any relationship with the child?
Chair Kinnegeyer, Representative Noble, no. Some of the confusion comes from there was a form that was created by the department right after the implementation of 1515 that asked the agencies in a way that was not consistent with the law to list every governmental entity with which they ever had any contact. So like the fire marshal or food services, all of those things. That is absurd, frankly, and is not encompassed in this. And the department has already stopped doing that after being advised by legal counsel that that was not required in the first place. So again, you'd go back to the language that says an entity that has a contract with the child caring agency for care of children. Mm-hmm. So like the fire marshal, for instance, is a regulatory entity, but that regulatory relationship is not the same as having a contract with the entity for the care of children.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think this is a really important bill, and you know, I'm eager to see it go forward. If there's any specific instance where this broadens it in a way that we don't intend it to and we can tweak it, then I'd be interested in hearing that before we do a work session. But I think it's a very important bill. So please don't take any of the questioning as not eager enthusiasm to go forward with the bill. I think you've done a lot of really important work on it with the department, and we just want to make sure we have the language right so that there's we don't inadvertently go in the direction that we're trying to go away from. So, okay. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 244.
Public hearing.
Close the public hearing on 244 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 245.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez. For the record, my name is still Sarah Gelser, and I'm still the senator from Corvallis and Albany and the surrounding area. Senate Bill 245 is easier. It's less confusing than all the notification language. And this simply clarifies what a child caring agency is and is not. In 1515, we needed to expand kids that are protected by abuse definitions to cover the ages of 18 to 21, because we now serve kids from the ages of 18 to 21. One example of why we needed to do that, there were instances where child caring agency staff were having sex with 18 to 21 year olds, but that couldn't be defined as abuse because they were 18, and 18 to 21 year olds weren't covered by the definition that says you can't have sex with your foster children. So we expanded that to include 18 to 21 year olds. However, when we did that, it created a little bit of a lack of clarity around what is and isn't a child caring agency, because there are places where there might be residential services to an 18 to 21 year old where it's not a child caring agency. So this bill basically excludes and says it is not a child caring agency. If you look on page 1, line 26, it says a child caring agency does not include. It has a list, and if you go to page 2, the added language is a facility that exclusively serves individuals 18 years of age and older. This is primarily going to be drug and alcohol treatment programs, and a facility that primarily serves both adults and children, but requires that any children must be accompanied at all times by at least one custodial parent or guardian, and you're looking at basically a homeless shelter, and that's what this bill does.
Another case of narrowing.
Yes.
Right. Okay, a cleanup bill. Any questions for Senator Gelser? Okay, we also have Cynthia Stinson and Janet Ahrens on this one.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the legislative coordinator for our Department of Human Services, Child Welfare, and this is a very simple bill. It is a cleanup and clarification so that we don't loop in, as Senator Gelser said, homeless shelters and other facilities where children may be there with their parents into child care agencies.
Agreed. Janet Ahrens with the Oregon Alliance Children's Programs. We support the bill.
Great. Any questions? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 245 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 760. I'm sorry, I've forgotten to ask you to do the summary. Go ahead. Why don't you do the summary on that?
Senate Bill 760 requires public or private officials to report suspected abuse of long-term care facilities, residents, or certain adults with developmental disability or mental illness after any contact with suspected abused person or abuser.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez. My name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the State Senator from Albany and Corvallis and Chair of the Senate Human Services Committee. What?
He says who?
Who? Never seen you before in my life. So Senate Bill 760 again, is a cleanup. If you are a mandatory reporter of child abuse, you are, I could give you a quiz, you are always a mandatory reporter of child abuse, regardless of how you come into that information, regardless of whether you're at work or it's the middle of the night. You suspect abuse, you're a mandatory reporter, you're required to report it. As a mandatory reporter for elder abuse or abuse of vulnerable adults, you're also required to report that. But depending on which category of adult, current law technically says for some of those people, you are responsible to report 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, regardless of how you come into the information. And for others, only during working hours and only for information you gain during your official duties. That's incredibly confusing. It doesn't make any sense. And so this bill just cleans that up and says mandatory reporters are mandatory reporters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And whether it's a vulnerable adult or a child, if you are concerned and you're a mandatory reporter, you need to make the report. The upside of this bill is most people think this is what the law is anyway, and this would basically make the law match what people believe to be true.
Okay. No one else has signed up to testify on this. Are there any questions for Senator Giltzer?
Yeah, I do. So, Senator Giltzer, I'm just kind of curious, how'd you catch this? I always kind of thought that was the case, 24/7.
Yeah. So did I.
Chair Kenny
Wake
Guyer.
Up middle of the night one night and just, oh.
She went to the ORS.
As you know, I wake up in the middle of the night every night and read the ORS's on abuse because that's all I think about. Which is actually almost right. True. This actually has come up a couple years in a row during our mandatory child abuse reporting training in the basement during legislative organizational days. And I thought that we did this last session, but I forgot to put the bill in. So I called Melissa after she gave us the presentation this time and said, didn't we fix that? Mm. And she said, no, actually, you did not. So here we go, and we will not go down that rabbit hole in our training next time, which should shave about 7 minutes off of our mandatory training.
Another good reason to vote for the bill.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 760. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 830.
Are you coming down for this one?
And Cassie, while he's going down, why don't you read us the summary?
Senate Bill 830 modifies the definition of current caretaker to mean a foster parent who is currently caring for a foster child or foster child sibling with a permanency plan for at least 12 cumulative months.
Chair Kenny Guyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm State Senator from Albany and Corvallis and Chair of the Senate Human Services Committee. Senate Bill 830 really builds on some legislation that Representative Stark led last session. And I think all that I will say about it, and I'll turn it over to Representative Stark, it ensures that we are making sure that when kids are going into the adoption process, that everyone that has a love and attachment for them is able to be considered by that adoption committee. And Representative Stark can tell this story in a far better way than I can.
Hi. Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. And in 2015, we passed Senate Bill 741. I believe it was unanimous going through the building. And the goal of Senate Bill 741 was to make sure that DHS had more options and more of an outline for when to allow foster parents to be considered for in the process of adoption. A little quick history on that. Prior to 2010, it was fairly easy to exclude family when considering adoption with children, and the legislature said, no, we want to make sure that there's a strong consideration for family. Roughly 2010, there was a bill that passed that said, hey, consider family first to the extent it's in the best interest of the child. And these are estimated dates, okay, based off of my civilian life at the time. And I have actually happened to be able to adopt my oldest daughter during prior to that change, so I saw the system at work at that point. And when it said to the extent of the best interest of the child, as time passed, it got to where that exception was rare, that if there was family involved, that there would be any consideration for the actual foster parents to be able to adopt that child. And in 2015, we cited numerous incidents where it just absolutely did not make sense that the foster parents weren't being considered. So we presented all that evidence. You guys said, hey, we agree with you. Let's actually make sure there's a strong outline here. And the magic number, we decided that we would say, you know what, after a year, there's significant attachment. There's some people that thought it should have been shorter, some people longer. But we settled as a legislature at a year. What we didn't really notice or think a whole lot about is the implementation of this, and that we in this bill at the time had written 12 months continuous. Well, if you've been around foster care, then children sometimes come in and out of care. So two stories for you specifically of how that continuous ended up kind of failing the children if people had not gotten involved. One of them is my own story. So while we were passing Senate Bill 741, I was going through that exact situation with my children, my two boys that we just finalized adoption with. They'd been with us for 16 months, and the department said family first. I removed myself from the conversation when the Senate was setting the implementation date so that I wouldn't unduly influence my own case. And the implementation date happened to be 6 weeks after my boys were shipped out to Connecticut to be adopted by an aunt and uncle who had never met them. And I'm quite convinced that if anybody sat down and looked at all the evidence at the time, that they would have said, you know what, the household they were in, my household, was a better fit, some of the trainings that we had and the relationships and so forth. Nonetheless, they went out there. So 6 months later, there's a failed adoption out there. They come back to our house. I was shocked when I found out Senate Bill 741, because it said 12 months continuous, it had to be immediately preceding. Our family had actually hit the reset button when they came back to us. So had a case manager not stepped in at the time and said, wait a minute, this is a cause for an extreme exception, or had a family member come forward at that time, even though they were now back with us for the second time, we would not have been considered for an adoptive placement. So we started taking a look at this and saying, wait a minute, that's not quite how we wanted this thing to work. About the same time, we got a call from I think both of us dealt with this. There are several, actually.
Many.
But we've dealt with several constituents that have had similar issues. The one that really stood out to me was, I love her email. It says, Deborah with Smiles is how her email comes across in my inbox. And their situation is she'd had this boy for about 9 months. And after 9 months, the boy went back to biological mother and for roughly 2 months. During that 2 months, she still had the child, so she was no longer receiving stipends from DHS, but the foster mom still had the child 3 to 4 nights a week, and on the other nights frequently would go over and take care of his medical needs while he was in this other placement. He then comes back into care, back to her house, and a couple months later, cumulative, had passed 12 months, but she was told that she would not be considered because there was a distant relative who was going to be the placement, because family first, if it hadn't been at least a year. That's about the time that Senator Gelser worked some magic of what Senator Gelser can sometimes do, and the department was influenced to go ahead and take a look and say, wait a minute, there's an exception process for a reason. We're not telling you to choose this family. We're telling you that you should be considering them. That was the intent of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they considered that. And we've actually been to those adoption parties and all as well. They actually, once they considered it, you know, we're not saying what they have to choose. We're just saying, you know, look at the options. Make the tough choice. We don't want a hard and fast outlined piece of paper to tell you exactly what you have to do in all these human situations that are all unique. We want you to have to make tough choices. We expect you to do that. So that was the goal of this. So about that time, we started saying we need to revise this bill and say 12 months cumulative. Is the point. You know, if you've spent that amount of time with a family, even if you are out for a week or out for a month or out for 2 months, it should be 12 months cumulative. So that was a long story or couple stories for a fairly short bill, but that's what we're trying to do here is change it from continuous to cumulative 12 months.
And if I could add, the thing that's really important is this is not giving the current caretaker an advantage in that adoption process. It just allows them to go to the committee. So the committee will be looking at all of the information around what is the best fit for that child. Sometimes that's going to be the current caretaker. Sometimes it's going to be a biological family member. And the rule around the adoption committee now requires that the adoption committee have individuals that both have an understanding of the importance of biological connection between people and the importance of attachment and relationship, because these are really difficult things to unpack, and it allows that committee to just really look at the individual circumstances of the child and the families to make sure that we're choosing from all of the loving options that are available for a child where they're most likely to best thrive.
So one more time, it's not playing favorites. It's saying widen your options.
Right, exactly. And it puts them, to begin with, on equal footing so that all of the considerations can be taken, as opposed to going in with a particular bias one way or the other.
Okay.
That's how I see it.
And I would say the adoption parties and celebrations are a lot of times in DHS work, it's very depressing, but those are some pretty extraordinary events to see how families are blended and come together. And I admit a bias. I'm an adoptive parent, so hooray for adoption.
And
it's
our
pretty
adoption,
awesome.
Our adoption celebration is Saturday at 5 o'clock in Grants Pass. You're free to come join us.
Yes. Yes, Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. Just a comment. I am sorry that I wasn't aware of being able to sign on to this earlier, so I've signed on to the bill. I think it's an absolute necessity. Some dear friends have gone through similar circumstances, which actually has resulted in the splitting of two children, where they have one and the other one is with someone else because they didn't have standing to at least show up. So I think this is a good bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank you both because it's very admirable work. I have a gentleman I work with, and we just had lunch last week talking about it. He has two siblings that are in foster care, that are on and off of foster care. And his frustration is that he doesn't feel the parent is actually able to take care of the children. So they're back and forth. They get into a wonderful, stable environment, and he's frustrated that they're sent back to this very unstable environment for a few months, back and forth. But I think when we look back at the children that are going through this, a couple of months feels like a lifetime. A year to us goes just like that now, but a year to them, you know, really helps them bond and build some great relationships. And I think I appreciate the work you're doing because the stability of our families and children in the state are so important. So thank you, and I look forward to supporting this too.
And if, Madam Chair, if I may, one more just general comment about the whole thing. It's unfortunate that we would need to micromanage the agency in this sort of way. That's why the original 2010-ish, I should look up that actual year. I just remember based off of our adoption. The original language said to the best extent of the child. That being said, I want to say on the agency's behalf, right now the agency is in the media under attack nonstop. Okay, and they are going through a lot of things, and so it's difficult for them to try to do anything outside of exactly what is written, and they are actually looking to the legislature to set for them the policies and the direction so that they actually have, you know, in a sense, an umbrella of protection guarding them from some of those outside attacks that are going on. And so that's why, you know, at least for this season, while we're, you know, kind of getting some things worked out with the agency, I do think it's important that we are as specific as possible on some of the direction that we want them to go. So there is no question. We're saying, and they have our backing on that when the media picks up with an unfortunate story or something like that.
I'll just say I agree with all that. If anything, I would go lower on the 12 months, down to 6 or 9 months, not because I think that it's always the case that there's not a biological family for them to go back to, and there needs to be time for rehabilitation and all that. But I feel like the pendulum swung way too far when you're looking at an aunt and uncle across the country that have no connection to the child at all. It's a very different situation than a biological parent who might be going through drug treatment. And so I think that when we create these rules that say family first, and it actually ties the hand of the agency, and the more flexibility that we can give for consideration, all kinds of consideration, I think is really important. So I think biological families that have been substantially involved in the children's development but need time to get back on track is a very different situation than, you know, the grandparent in, I sat through a particular case at one point that involved sending the child back from a foster family to grandparents in Mexico, and the child had never been to Mexico, didn't speak Spanish, grandparents didn't speak English. I mean, that's really when we've gone way too far. So I would lean in the direction of flexibility. I was very supportive of the bill. I guess it was in 2015. Your bill that you're referring to would have been 2009 or 2011, because 2010 was a special session back when we had, you know, just biennial years. So I'm very supportive of this effort, and probably
if it were up to me, it would have gone even farther. But I know that's very, it's very controversial. But for me, it's not saying that one is better than the other. I think that Senator Gelser put it really well, of trying to balance those the bonding and attachment, and then a lot of the research that shows how important it is to reunify with biological families. Those are all very compelling reasons for the placement committee to take into account. But the more we get involved and put on these restrictions that don't make sense is ridiculous. So, and Representative Noble. Or is it Representative Vice Chair Sanchez?
It was
me. It was you.
It was me. So, of course, notwithstanding anything with regard to the Indian Child Welfare Act, right, these pieces. But I'm just a little concerned only because as I'm reading here, APLA, and so I've seen some situations that aren't so great as what you're trying to get to, where a foster parent has really pushed very hard to make that APLA situation happen when there were relatives, and of course specifically Native relatives, because that's my area of work. And I guess I want to hear from the agency kind of how they feel like something, a situation like that might work out, because it just concerns me sometimes that even though this is the intent to not give necessarily a foster parent a leg up but a consideration, what we have in the system that we're concerned and worried about all the time is the implicit bias of what is better for a child. And sometimes that implicit bias might indicate that, well, this home with mom and dad and 2.5 other kids is so much better than, you know, single, you know, auntie who has three other kids who is trying to pull it together and keep it together, but that's, you know, a relative. So I'm just concerned about those types of things that might make it a little difficult to sort of make that decision, and really, again, implicit bias exists in our system, and we have to figure out how we deal with that and not make it so that kids can't be with relatives if just because we don't think it's the best situation.
And Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, all of those I agree with and are incredibly important. I think one of the places that we have to address that is very early on when a child is coming into care and that family find. And we should be doing everything that we can to be sure that a child, when they're going into care in the first place, are going into care with a relative. We shouldn't be waiting to do that relative search or the family find until until parental rights have been terminated. That should happen much earlier, so that we don't end up with these conflicts to start with. And that's actually one of the reasons why I actually do think the 12 months is an important piece, because that allows time for that family finding process to take place. And the department can probably speak to it better, but I do know when we worked on Representative Stark's bill last session, we did look at ICWA a lot to make sure that this wasn't kind of impacting that piece. And it is only at the point where rights have been terminated and the adoption, it's been determined that an adoption is going to take place.
Follow up, please. Thank you. We're specifically talking about adoption.
Correct. This is adoption.
Okay.
This is
not how it reads to me. So
this is the process where you go to the adoption committee. So the committee looks, and they might have several candidate families that they are looking at. We have these willing individuals that are willing to adopt this child. Sometimes there might be an aunt on the maternal side and an aunt on the paternal side, and the mm-hmm. committee looks at both of those and makes a recommendation. What this would say is aunt on the maternal side, aunt on the paternal side, and the foster family that's cared for that child for at least 12 months. And then that adoption committee would look at all of these individuals to look at, you know, how old is the child? How's the child doing in school? Is the child going to have to move? Does the child have, you know, a close relationship with this aunt on the maternal side or aunt on the paternal side? Do they have special needs? I think that's something that Representative Stark pointed to earlier, that you know, one family is more equipped to handle than another. But it's not APLA. This really is adoption.
Okay.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, may on your previous statement as far as the 12 months, there still does very much exist the ability for the department to have an exception to the 12-month rule and give current caretaker status at less than 12 months. And, in fact, that is what they did in our case because we had not made this change. Mm-hmm. So in our case, they went ahead and you know, had a hearing and so forth and granted us current caretaker status earlier. I'm hoping, and I know that at least two legislators in the building have made it very clear with the agency that we expect that they do take a look at those really unique, odd situations that are outside of the 12-month period mm-hmm. to take a look at are there times to make that exception. And so they do have the flexibility and freedom to do that. We expect mm-hmm. them to do that, but it shouldn't be the norm. It should be an exception. Mm-hmm. So.
And if I could just add one more thing, one of the and I remember Representative Stark talking about this 2 years ago when we had the original bill, that the pendulum in child welfare tends to swing. So we'll see we have this implicit bias and we are favoring foster families too much. And then we try to fix that, so then we favor biological families too much. The goal when doing this of just having everybody go to the committee was to get out of that absolute. Because however, you can make a really great argument for emotional and experiential attachment, and you can make a really great argument for biological attachment even when there hasn't been intimate knowledge between the two people in a relationship. And we can't really make that decision overall as a public policy. We need a committee of people that is really able to look at the unique circumstances of those children and those families, and how do you work that out? And this is one of the things that I just wish for our child welfare system as a whole. In private adoption, we no longer, especially in Oregon, look at adoption as this iron curtain that falls between a biological family and a child. We have this idea of open adoption where families become big and extended, and the idea that a child can never have too many people to love them. I know my daughter, we have ongoing, frequent, weekly communications with her biological relatives, and that's, I think, the best possible thing for our child, for the birth family, and for us. If we could move that way in child welfare as well, so that when the child goes through a trauma of being removed from their family, even if they're going to another biological relative, that we don't say, you no longer can have any contact with your mother or your father. What if we could move towards this open adoption theory in child welfare, where we maintain safe connection, where that relationship continues to be strong, and you're not severing that really important bond just because that individual who loves their child very much and their child loves them very much doesn't have the capacity to provide safe care, even though they do have the capacity to love and remain in relationship with that mm-hmm. that person. I don't know how we do that through public policy. I think mm-hmm. part of it is we have to change the way that we think about children, and I think we still think very much about children as property, that would I be threatened by my child having another mother or having someone else that they love? It takes us getting to a place to recognize that, again, a child and an adult can never have too many people to love them, and I hope that's a place that we can move to in Oregon and other places as mm-hmm. well.
Very well said. Okay. Great. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Senate Bill 830 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 104.
That's not mine, is it?
Maybe.
Gosh darn it.
I guess not. Oh. If you wanted to stay and comment on it.
No, this is not mine.
It's the registry.
But it's a very good bill.
Okay.
There you go.
For the record.
The best.
Cassie, why don't you read the summary?
Senate Bill 104 clarifies provisions for Department of Human Services criminal background check registry for persons who work or seek to work in providing care to children, elderly, or persons with disabilities, and the bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez. For the record, my name is Frank DeVorsa-Miles, and I'm the unit manager for the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority background check unit. On OLIS, we've got two sheets entitled Frank Miles Fact Sheet mm-hmm. and Frank Miles Handout. Which actually is a two-sider, but this part's probably the most important part. To some degree, the Frank Miles' fact sheet goes through essentially what I'll be presenting here, so I won't belabor too much of that piece. But Senate Bill 104 is a proposal from DHS and the Background Check Unit to amend language in ORS 443.006 so that intellectual developmental disability and mental health adult foster homes would be included on the long-term care registry, with the following benefits: maintenance of safety for clients while reducing redundant background checks, less cost in fingerprinting and other related costs from background checks, less hiring time for employers, and faster service times for clients served by IDD and mental health adult foster homes. House Bill 4151 in the 2014 session, which added 443.006, specifically excluded IDD and mental health adult foster homes from the long-term care registry. Currently, thus, neither IDD and mental health adult foster home licensees nor prospective employees of IDD and mental health adult foster homes can tap the registry's portability benefits, therefore requiring new background checks for any individuals offered positions or promoting in those adult foster homes. The exclusion consequently creates unnecessary delays when IDD and mental health adult foster homes need to hire quickly due to staffing needs or emergent care requirements. An individual on BCU's long-term care registry, and kind of this handout kind of goes through some of what we review for everyone on the registry, but anyone on the long-term care registry has already completed a criminal history and abuse check in order to be added to that registry. Once added, the individual does not have to complete a background check to be hired for another registry-affected position during a two-year certification period. Right now, home care workers, personal support workers, residential care, nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and adult foster homes for the aging are all included currently on the registry. Just some information in terms of 26 totals and averages. We completed a total of 3,497 IDD and mental health adult foster home staff and volunteer background checks in 2016. Registry portability is usually averaged around 20.61%, where they were able to be hired immediately due to the portability offered for the registry if they're moving between any of those types of roles covered. If IDD and mental health adult foster homes have been included in the long-term care registry, approximately 721 employers and at least as many subject individuals and as many clients that they serve would have benefited from the portability. Approximately, it would save us about $58,000 per biennium if we were to pass SB 104. I'll open it up to questions.
Representative Noble.
Thank you. Memory care facilities. It's been a topic here in this committee a little bit. Is this included with the registry?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, yes, memory care is included already.
They were already.
Okay, I just clarifying because differences in SNPs versus residential care, and one of the things that we discovered, I guess.
But is adult foster care homes is what you're adding to this for IDD and mental health? Are there other settings besides adult foster homes?
Chair Kenny Geyer, we have some DOJ interpretation of the changes to SB 104 that suggests that we could actually expand it further, and IDD in general is considering adding all of their programs because recent federal changes have required a two-year certification anyway. Mm-hmm. So looping them on into this is a possibility with the current language of SB 104.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the registry sort of automatically check and re-up and that kind of thing? Because I love I love that possibility, but does it automatically do that, or just is somebody working on doing that? I'm just worried because I know that I have hired somebody whose background check came out great and then had them on for a couple of years, and then turns out they had stuff that happened in between that time.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez. We have two factors, I suspect, in that. We are continuously updating as new information comes on in, both the registry, and we'll also reach out to an employer when we've found new history so that there's a new background check that's done. So there's two facets of that in terms of, and to a certain degree, this chart kind of explains what we do that. In terms of, effectively, we will take a look at someone on the for the registry, if it's a registry-affected position, see if they pass at the highest level across all the programs that we include in the registry, and then we will do a background check specific to that person's position that's coming on in if they don't make it for the registry. So they could be denied for the registry, approved for the position, or they could potentially be approved for both or denied for both. In addition, as we add in new requirements from federal bodies, whether it's Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or we get that new history, we're constantly having to potentially review, change rules, and or just ask an employer for a new background check on an individual because of that new history. So there's a lot of factors that are continuously in play.
Cool. Thanks. I think one thing that I found interesting when I first saw this adding to the registry, I thought, why didn't this go to Ways and Means? Why did it come here? And the fact that it actually saves money because of no duplication of background checks, basically, right? Because there must be a little bit of cost for you to expand the number of people on the registry. But it's outweighed, I assume, by the savings from the reducing the duplicity of. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions on this? Some good materials online. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 104. And was there any questions, announcements from the committee? We are adjourned.
Thank you.
The committee? We are adjourned.
Thank you.